deregulation and globalization kicked in, and it became the consensus. It became the story of the city of Washington. Anyone, whether in a Republican administration or in President Clinton's Democratic administration, that sought to try to engage in regulation of markets was brushed aside. I can imagine that if you were someone with a professional mission who saw yourself as a regulator in Washington during the 1990s when a Democrat was president, or during this decade when a Republican was president, and sitting around a table and saying, wait a minute, shouldn't we know something about these derivatives? Shouldn't we know something about credit default swaps? You would very quickly learn that you had no room at that table, and if you wanted to keep your career going at all, you would either say nothing or play along or quit. So this convinces me, when you look at the trajectory of what was tried and failed, that this is a serious systemic crisis of not just the financial system, but a crisis of ideology, a crisis of governance, a crisis of politics, and a crisis of intellectual thought.
My name is Sean Macheza, and you're listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a counter-history by the Transnational Institute. Over the course of 5 episodes, we'll cover some of the major moments that have shaped the international left over the last 50 years. It's a story of ideas, movements, and personalities who have shaped the world today. It's a story of the rise of new forms of capitalism and authoritarianism. It's also the story of a global progressive think tank, the Transnational Institute, or TNI. And above all, it's a story of resistance and hope. You just heard Howard Washtell speaking at a TNI IPS panel on November 7, 2008, as the global financial crisis began. In this, our 4th episode, we'll talk about the fallout of the financial crisis, the rise of new forms of authoritarianism, and the new movements that shook the world in the last decade. The austerity and pain that would follow the financial crisis would usher in a bleak period in the global north, for some. Susan George talks about how austerity was structural adjustment coming to Europe.
The IMF and the World Bank had these plans, which came straight out of the Washington Consensus mill. Washington Consensus is a term invented by an American economist, and it has stuck. But the rules are basically the same today as they were yesterday. It's the same thing with agribusiness yesterday, agribusiness today. The more things change, the more they remain the same. And structural adjustment today is going on full force in Europe. That's what the austerity plans are. And instead of saying export your cash crops, which is what they were saying to the countries of the indebted South in the 19, they're saying export whatever you've got to export, but you've got to be competitive. And that's the big watchword now. And that is what we're living under. So cut public spending, and that means always health, social services, education. Cut that first. Don't necessarily cut military spending. Some people do it, but only as a last resort. And it is the same thing, because they are indebted. Why are they indebted? It's not because they have been living beyond their means. That's the propaganda. That is the ideological explanation. Not at all. They are indebted because they are paying for having saved the banks. And the GDP of Europe, on average, went down by about 5%. At the same time, there were a lot of people unemployed. They had to pay unemployment compensation. At the same time, less taxes were coming into the national budget, and therefore a crisis of indebtedness, difficulties to pay back. And so come in with the Washington Consensus and do exactly the same thing, which impoverished the South, caused what they now call the lost decade for development, and we called it that even then in the 80s, and it is not going to do the people any good at all. However, this is what business is happy with, and I think that they are simply following the business scenario. And that top 1%, or it's actually 1% of 1%, wants to claw back all of the gains of working people over the last 50, 60 years. This is very clear to me, that we are now in that phase in Europe, and the neoliberals are in control. And perhaps what I was surprised at, although I should not have been surprised, was that after the crisis, this kind of capitalism became more and more entrenched. Not only did they win, but they won big, and they are really dictating policy now throughout the world.
Walden Bello is a fellow at TNI and involved with the Transnational Institute since the early 1990s. He is co-chair of the board of Focus on the Global South and the author of more than 20 books.
We in the left had been warning about deregulation of the financial sector. For instance, we in Focus on the Global South, which has been closely allied with TNI, we were pretty much engaged in the battle against capital account liberalization, which was being pushed by the IMF across the world, and in particular in East Asia. Look at how the liberalization of the capital account of investment, both direct and portfolio investment rules, were just flooding the Asian economies with massive capital that was going to not so much to industry or agriculture, but to real estate and to the stock market. And we said that at some point there was going to be a major crisis because of the way that it was pumping up growth artificially, and prices were getting sky high, real estate prices, stock prices. And then when they came crashing down, I think the analysis coming from the left, from us, from Focus, from TNI, about the way that finance had basically created these massive bubbles, that when they broke, these bubbles broke, they broke down whole economies with them. And that, so we analyzed the 1997-1998 Asian financial crisis. And we did say that this crisis could prefigure something that was bigger. But pretty much the warnings that we had were ignored, and the U.S. was supposed to be impervious to the dark side of financialization. And then, of course, we saw that in 2008 that came about. I think we in TNI were not surprised by 2008 because we had already seen the dynamics of runaway financialization in 1997 and 1998 in the Asian financial crisis. I don't think we really had solid campaigns on financial regulation. I'm talking about the left now in general. That was distinct from the call for financial regulation by the more liberal sectors, especially after 2008. I think for the most part, our analysis was mainly critical, and very good critical analysis. But in terms of alternatives that would be distinguished from what was being offered by the Democrats or the liberals, I think we were more fuzzy in that area, because it was also a question of having to think through what is the role of finance in a progressive economy. And that, I think, we really hadn't had that worked out. But the one area, though, I think where people had solid footing was climate finance, and the idea that climate justice involved, the idea that climate finance was needed to be guided by the principles of justice, in which since the and that climate finance must not be handled by the World Bank, but by other mechanisms if it was going to succeed. And of course, the other thing about financialization was that was coupled with the deindustrialization of the United States and to some extent Europe. And basically what you had was investment being channeled to the more profitable sectors of the economy, like finance. And as far as jobs were concerned, the manufacturing was concerned, that was being shipped abroad. And this was the period when the global value chains were being established in this globalized kind of economy, which, when you come right out of it, product was China became the manufacturer of the world. You had the industrialization in Europe and the United States. Financialization of the economy led to this very severe crisis in the United States of indebtedness. Our critique of financialization, the left, of PNI, Focus, and others, was spot on, I think. But what would be a progressive financial sector? We didn't really think that through. Now, the other thing that I think we really had to do was to make finance understandable. It was complex. Capitalist finance is really complex. So it was very important to break that down for people. That sort of popular education on finance really remains to be done. It is a major task in terms of understanding not only finance, but global capitalism as a whole, that that process of education must really take place, especially at this time, because there's a lot of resentment against Wall Street. There's a lot of resentment against financialization. There's a lot of people that feel that they've been had by the elite. I think in Europe, you see this happening. And in the United States, you have fascist politics being combined with anti-Wall Street rhetoric on the part of the Republican Party. So there's the policies of the Democrats and the liberals, centrists, center-left, center-right, have created this crisis for so many working people. And it's essential that we at least that we play an educational role in terms of making people understand what was really happening, because you can create this kind of fascist, populist, anti-capitalist, quote-unquote, politics that rides on these frustrations and really leads to not the end of capitalism, but a reconfiguration of capitalism that is dangerous for all, which we're now seeing that in the United States. So that sort of education must, of course, take place alongside organizing. And that's really the challenge at this point in time. We have to out-organize the right. At the same time, we have to outmaneuver them in terms of ideas. And that's, I think that's the challenge. And it's not, as I've said several times, it's not certain that we're going to win. But the recognition of the great dangers and the possibility we won't win is probably the first step to really shaking us up so that we take this task of presenting and thinking about and organizing about them away from our sectarian divisions and reconstitutes us as a political force, because the left is so badly fragmented while the right is coming together. And of course, the center has disappeared.
Sol Trumbo-Vila is a program coordinator and researcher working at the Transnational Institute for over a decade.
For the 2008 crisis, I think what is important to understand in that context is how neoliberal thinking was exposed, and that it was a system that was not for the benefit of the majority of the population. Neoliberalism was based on some of the premises of the capitalist system. This idea that if you work hard and just with the force of your will, you can thrive and have a good life. Even further, if you take risks, like becoming an entrepreneur or by investing your savings instead of expending them, you are entitled or even encouraged to become rich and powerful. The other side of the coin, the story goes, was if you don't take smart decisions and you take risks that are not the best, then you actually can become bankrupt and lose your position. So basically, it's this idea that if you play the game and take risks, you can win big time, but that you can also lose. Therefore, this constant idea of social Darwinism, which capitalism has been always based upon, this idea that those who are smarter and better play with the environment and behave better, they will just thrive and they will continue, and that's actually a natural process. However, with the 2008 crisis, that spell, that idea was completely broken. Because when the shit hit the fan with the financial crisis, those who had become the richest of all to a level that were unprecedented in human history, especially the investment bankers and the financial sector in general, in theory, they had taken very bad decisions. Therefore, they would have to be punished and be bankrupt and really lose their power. But then we were told a different story, and really became the way to really confront the system. So in that context is when I started working at TNI, and my focus was really on the consequences of the financial crisis in Europe. So I did research on, we have this wave of privatization processes in Europe, so who is actually benefiting from them? And by looking at those processes of privatization, we found out that often you have the same companies behind those processes, especially financial advisory firms or law firms. So you could see there was an industry who was really benefiting from this. So we call it the privatizing industry in Europe. As a follow-up of that, we looked into the banking sector, and that meant, okay, we have all these bailout packages being imposed by what was called the Troika, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. So let's see who is behind. And then we looked on the major cases all over Europe, and we found out, again, financial advisory firms were involved, and often the same ones everywhere. So from the privatization of the postal service in the UK, to the airport management in Spain, to harbors in Greece, you have the same corporations behind.
Financial turmoil cascaded onto real economies, and austerity quickly began to bite, creating fertile ground for unrest and upheaval. Key to the politics that would shape authoritarian streaks in countries all over the global north were questions of people on the move, the relentless so-called war on terror, contesting and delegitimizing protest and civil society, and perhaps underlying it all, an anti-Muslim racism that would eventually underpin a genocide. Here's Niv Nivrian, a program coordinator for the Transnational Institute's War and Pacification work.
We looked a lot at the way migrant solidarity was being criminalized, for example, and we looked at the criminalization of the BDS movement, so boycott, divest, sanction, which has been hugely instrumental in bringing about a situation where you have entities that are connected with Israel or that are actively supporting Israel. And at that point, there wasn't an ongoing genocide in the same way that there is now. There was obviously an illegal occupation and horrific human rights violations and decades of repression. And I suppose we looked at the BDS movement because it was so successful, and it is really successful. And that is being borne out today in what we're seeing in terms of Israel is crumbling in many ways, and it's the support for Israel from the big multinationals is falling apart. And it is the demise. It's slow. It really needs to go much faster. And what a massive sacrifice that the Palestinians are. The genocide is ongoing 10 months in. So we looked early on at the kind of the shrinking space, the criminalization of BDS solidarity, and the idea that when a movement is being successful, that's when it's being criminalized. And the BDS movement has been really successful. And then on the anti-racism stuff, we looked very much at Islamophobia. I suppose the earlier work in the program before my time at TNI was very much about counterterrorism and the war on terror and kind of all of the policies that flowed from this supposed war on terror strategy. And yeah, like I said, again, the high intensity wars that were going on in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but then also the lower level but really devastating politics that were being rolled out through countering violent extremism measures that were being rolled out in Europe, and then actually took effect and were rolled out much more broadly.
Countering Violent Extremism, CVE, refers to a set of policies adopted around the world that were designed to prevent radicalism and terrorism, ostensibly by mobilizing community responses to head off radicalism before it could take off. The policies have, perhaps unsurprisingly, led to mass surveillance, heavy-handed policing, and shrinking space for many communities, particularly Muslim communities in Europe.
So we looked at the countering violent extremism stuff and very specifically how it focused in on Muslims and how it became a form in which Islamophobia and Islamophobic policies were normalized and were actually baked into state policy. So we looked at that from different shapes and forms. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now playing out on the streets in England, for example, and even, yeah, just in the Netherlands, where we have far right government, a lot of the reason why it came into power was because it ran its campaign on a de-Islamifying the Netherlands strategy. So we've really seen what started out as supposedly policies to counter terrorism actually ending up normalizing entirely, putting into state-structured policies the idea that it's okay to discriminate against Muslims.
Politics of grievance weren't playing out in Europe and the United States only, but everywhere they played out, one thing was clear. As neoliberal capitalism consolidated, such politics became almost inevitable. Here's Achin Fanaic.
The growing economic development of India, which created a much wider, in numerical terms, what we can call a middle class, with in purchasing power terms, the same kind of standard of living or similar standard of living to countries in Europe, will be 110 million, 150 million that year now. But this middle class is extremely reactionary. And this reaction is what also fed into the kind of right-wing consolidation of neoliberalism in India. And different nationals, remember what I said about states being the crucial mechanism for stabilizing capitalist globalization. And you began to have authoritarian nationalisms as a consequence and connected to the transmission of neoliberal capitalist globalization, taking different forms. But all of these authoritarian populisms are authoritarian nationalisms. All of these authoritarian nationalisms scapegoat somebody in order to maintain support, either internally, externally, or both. In the 60s and 70s, there was anti-racism. And even maybe in the early 80s, there was anti-racism in Europe. But it becomes more Islamophobic, anti-immigrant, this thing, and more Islamophobic later on. So you have the same phenomenon connected to neoliberalism of scapegoating. And in the Indian case, this became something that was very disturbing. And it hit home to us that this is also an internationalist aspect. And this growing Islamophobia is also something that serves interests on a global level. In the case of the United States after 2001, it served its purposes. In Russia, don't forget about Chechnya and others in terms of there. In China, you have Xinjiang, Muslims, I think. In India, you have Kashmir. And in Europe, you have anti-immigrant, particularly from North Africa, whatever, Muslims and all, also reinforced by the demonization of Muslims everywhere. The question of global emancipatory dimension, one thing is very clear. You cannot simply fight against communalism. You have to recognize that you cannot hope to move against these things unless you also fight against neoliberal capitalism. So when we're talking about the global emancipatory potential, for me, the question of moving to overcome neoliberal capitalist globalization is absolutely central. I would go further. I would suggest that neoliberal capitalist globalization is now the main form of capitalism. It has its variations here. But please note something that's very interesting, and that is that when the Great Depression took place in the 1930s, you had it shift from war economy and then towards Keynesianism. When Keynesianism goes into crisis, you have neoliberalism. When neoliberal capitalist accumulation goes into crisis between 2008 and 2012, 2013, what do you have after that? Not a shift in reverse or anything, but business as usual. Neoliberalism remains the dominant form. And neoliberalism really comes about politically because in different countries at different times, you have a shift in the relationship of forces between labor and capital. Labor is defeated. And now, unlike the wartime mobilization of the Second World War and subsequently, labor is much weaker in relation to capital. And this is the case in Europe, and it is most certainly the case in India. And we have a common struggle in terms of how to actually strengthen this to fight against it.
Another dimension is that the left's internationalism is co-opted by the right.
Internationalism was always associated with the left. The left with international against capital, international for women's rights, international against racism, international here. What's happened in the last 30, 40 years is that now it's the right that has internationalism. Through neoliberalism, you have this idea. If you like, Marx said, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Now it's elites of the world unite. You have nothing to lose, certainly not your privileges. So there is a greater degree relative unification in various ways within the ruling class and elites. We must now actually counter. TNI is one important component of that.
And indeed, a new resistance was taking shape.
We were told that some banks were too big to fail, and that we all have to bear the cost. In other words, profits from the system were private, but we have to socialize the costs. And just to put a bit things on perspective, in the European Union, like in the United States, there was this massive aid to the banking system, which in the case of the European Commission, between 2008 and 2017, almost 1,500 billion euros were given as capital-like aid, and then 3,500 billion in liquidity aid. This is 5,000 billion euros from the public sector, the taxpayers, to aid the financial sector. 5,000 billion. Just a comparison, in case it's useful, we are having huge debates in Europe about aid to Ukraine, for instance. The total aid is 117 billion. So we are taking about 50 times the aid that was spent on the financial sector. Of course, that created enormous problem of public debt. So that meant that what was a financial crisis because of the decisions taken by the speculators became a public debt crisis. And from the public debt crisis, then it became a social crisis because we were told that we had to pay this debt. And that meant privatization of public education, healthcare, destruction of social labor rights, etc. And there was enormous resistance to it, no? The best example in Europe was in Greece, which was the most paradigmatic case of how, basically the decisions taken by the private sector were socialized to the rest. And that really triggered enormous sense of urgency to be organized, and not only at the national level, but also at the international level. And Greece was a very important example, but also was Spain. Meaning, in the case of Spain, that hundreds of thousands of people were being evicted by their homes because they weren't able to pay their mortgages. And the banks who were evicting them were actually banks that were being saved by public money. So you had just a situation where people were becoming homeless, people with family and children, because banks had been speculating. We were saving those banks with public money, but still those banks could expel people. So the situation in Spain in that case was very intense, or really unbearable. So that led to a new form of mobilizing. And just to give some strokes on that, I mentioned before this occupation of the public space. That was something very unique of this time, no? Which was inspiration from Tahrir Square and Egypt, no? And the radical revolution there. It was copied by the Spanish movement. Then was also copied by the Greek movement occupying Syntagma Square in Athens. And that also inspired then United States activists to say, okay, let's just go to Wall Street and occupy the public space and see what happens, no? And that really triggered a new form of mobilizing, because there was a global day of action in October 2011 that meant 1,000 demonstrations were organized all over the world, which end up in 1,000 occupations. And that was extremely powerful because it really changed the way progressive and left movements were working for a long time, which was often based on long discussions around political manifestos. So you will have very long discussions about, okay, this is our political platform, meaning this is our common demands, and how to build an alliance around these demands, no? And it's not to diminish the importance to at some point do that, but these movements started with an action. And that action of occupying the public space, which first were the squares, and there were occupation of libraries, of old police stations, of universities, etc., that act really allowed for a way of mobilizing that broke the typical silos of the left movements, no? Because in an occupation, everybody could be involved. A trade union, ecologist movement, feminist movement, new people who wanted to organize, no? So this idea of action was very important and really became the way to really confront the system. And that was replicated all over the world in many different ways. For some of us involved on that, we call this the 2011 generation, because it was a very important year. I will argue as important as 1968, because it was really global. It had radical transformative change in revolutions from the Arab Spring and occupations in the global north, but also in many places in the global south. The Arab Spring, the revolution in Tunisia, and then the revolution in Egypt really had a strong effect in the political consciousness of my generation. And as a result of that, in Spain, there was a new social movement that was called the Indignados, the Outraged, or the 15M, because it started in a 15th of May demonstration. And basically, that movement had enormous success, itself organized without any major political party or trade union or any other traditional power structure from the left progressive side. And they decided to copy what the Egyptians have done in the Tahrir Square, to occupy the main square of the city and camp there so that it will become a kind of a headquarters of the resistance. And that spread to 60 cities around Spain in less than a week.
Taking shape at this time was another movement. For decades, TNI and movements around the world had been closely watching the actions of transnational corporations and how, all too often, they could escape any consequences for criminal acts. Breed Brennan is a popular educator and political activist, working with the Transnational Institute since the early 1990s. She focuses on international governance, the role of transnational corporations, and efforts to hold them to account.
The track record of transnational corporations in relation to violations, widespread violations of human rights, of labor rights, of displacement of communities, of the use of paramilitaries for the repression of communities, and also for crimes against nature. And until now, we do not have an international body that can impose binding obligations on transnational corporations and hold them accountable. Therefore, they are operating actually with impunity.
A response to the crimes committed and facilitated by transnational corporations, mostly in the global south. International law has proved impotent and cowardly, but under relentless pressure from global movements, finally something started to move. Dirty Guerrero is a long-term collaborator with the Transnational Institute. She has been an organizer, researcher, educator, and campaigner in social movements and NGOs for almost 30 years. She works on and writes about climate change and energy issues and the impacts of globalized trade and investments on people's livelihoods.
Because if we look in the globally now, after the Arab Empire, many global South communities and social movements still see that the age of empire did not really disappear, because in their case, it came back in the form of investments. It came back in the form of powerful corporations that dictate what they eat, how will they get their medicines, what kind of goods will be in the supermarket. So that era of monopoly capitalism is something that people need to grapple with, that the power of corporation is so much that it is actually a new empire. They can go wherever they want to go, where they want to go, do whatever they want to do in countries where governments have very little power to stop their impunity. So again, that concept that people can fight the impunity of transnational corporations is very important.
Where did the campaign to dismantle corporate power come from? Where did it originate? Affected communities who insisted that we cannot tolerate, we will not tolerate this level of impunity from the crimes of transnational corporations have, in a sense, through this challenge to social movements and to campaign networks for a major convergence around that question. So in 2000, after a year's consultation with social movements, campaign networks in the major global regions, the campaign was launched in 2012 in Rio. And this campaign was launched on the call, actually, to reclaim, it was a call for action, to reclaim people's sovereignty over economy, politics, and culture and environment. And of course, it has a specific call to stop corporate impunity. There are two major strategies in the campaign. One is the building of a people's treaty. We need actually to take the discourse, reinvent it, and put our own rethinking about treaties, about law, in the people's hands. And this is the first strategy of the campaign to dismantle corporate power. It's to build a people's treaty for economic sovereignty, political sovereignty, and therefore the people's treaty has two elements. One is a juridical element, so that people reclaim also the responsibility to articulate a new legal framework and to advance in that struggle with agreements among the peoples. The second element is actually to build the alternatives, because I think within the campaign it's clear we will not have a shift in juridical power or in the asymmetry that we currently have if we cannot shift the question of alternatives and build a base for a different economy and a different politics. The second element of the strategy actually is to tackle the question of initially a binding treaty at the UN in terms of transnational corporations. I mean, I don't know if any of you have been following the story, but it's incredible how entrenched corporate capture is at the UN. It took Ecuador, a small country, but of course which has suffered greatly at the side of corporate exploitation, and South Africa to lead in 2013 a call at the UN to establish a binding treaty. This really was like rebellion from governments inside the UN. And of course, we don't believe actually that governments will solve this problem, certainly not. But the fact that 85 governments in 2013 put this resolution to the UN really changed the equation. And in June of this year, 2014, the UN Human Rights Council voted with 20 votes for a binding treaty, 12 voted against, and 11 abstained. There are 11 members of the European Union in the UN Human Rights Council. All 11 voted against. There was a very dirty battle inside the UN on this question, and it was extraordinary to actually see the collapse of European state sovereignty. There is no such thing operational in the UN anymore. It's going to be a very tough battle because, of course, actually what happened in June at the UN happened not only because a number of governments stuck their head out. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. They were threatened on the floor of the UN to kind of forget about this. Let's keep to the cozy consensus that all we can do with transnational corporations is voluntary guidelines. I mean, this was really extraordinary. I mean, this is the glass ceiling that corporations have given us in terms of how we see our economies developing. This is the 21st century capitalism. This is where we are at in neoliberal globalization as far as global governance is concerned. Maybe to come back to the campaign, we see the People's Treaty as very important in putting people's struggles and people's movements as the protagonists of a new juridical and political regime. This, of course, is a long-term struggle. But as you know, as many people have said here today, we have to start where we are and with the political imagination to go forward. The second thing is that this struggle is really about, it's a political struggle. We can fire all the nice technical points we want, and we will have to do that, and it's a very challenging juridical process as well. But it is about political struggle. And in the coming year, we will be launching the very initial zero draft of the People's Treaty. We plan to have a consultation, at least one major consultation in every region globally. We expect that this will generate an incredible sort of energy, enthusiasm, and determination of people to end corporate impunity and to go forward with claiming people's sovereignty in the area of economics and politics.
The global campaign to reclaim people's sovereignty, dismantle corporate power, and stop impunity. This campaign, which I started to get involved a bit in the same period. So when the last Blockupy mobilizations happened, that was already like 2015. And this is when I started to get involved in this global campaign, which was a truly global movement to confront corporate power and impunity. So the story of this campaign, it's really a result of decades of work by many activists and social movements. This is a global campaign that now is composed by more than 250 organizations from civil society, social movements, trade unions, affected communities by transnational corporations, indigenous groups affected by transnational corporations, and its membership, if you count those who are part of organizations that are part of the campaign, are more than 250 million people who are organized or linked with this effort. This campaign started as a result of years of work, especially between Europe and Latin America. This relationship was called Enlazando Alternativas, which means linking alternatives. And it really got concrete by the organization of Permanence People's Tribunal. The Permanence People's Tribunal, it's a practice that is several decades old, which tries to create international law from law by providing evidence of crimes by those who are not accountable otherwise, especially transnational corporations, but it can be also governments. There have been Permanence People's Tribunal addressing the crimes of different governments. So there was a Permanence People's Tribunal process, which takes years, to expose the crimes of European corporations in Latin America, which are many and are, yeah, very long, from mining to energy companies, agribusiness, etc. And by that work, there was this will to create a kind of a coordinated effort to address those crimes. But very soon it became clear that this problem was truly global. So it was not only European corporations in Latin America, but there were, of course, US corporations all over the world, European corporations all over the world. So then in 2012, in Rio de Janeiro, there was the launch of this global campaign to reclaim people's sovereignty, dismantle corporate power, and stop impunity. And the first big effort of this campaign was to create a people's treaty, because there was this understanding that we have these extremely powerful corporations who are committing crimes all over the world. They are involved in destruction of ecosystems, killing of human rights defenders, they lobby governments, they change governments if they can. And we need to do something about it because there is no international regulation to address this. So the idea was to create a people's treaty, a bottom-up process, so that we will create a new set of international law. I remember I was just in TNI for a few weeks, and I remember they were having those meetings up in the seminar room with people all over the world, and I was just hearing here and there, no? It was very inspiring. As a result of that process, soon enough, many groups working in the human rights framework, so civil society organizations working especially around UN institutions, they saw that it was a good moment to actually try to have an international treaty at the United Nations so that we can hold transnational corporations accountable. So this idea came about, and there was a proposal to have a resolution in the Human Rights Council in Geneva in 2014. And as my colleagues said, especially Gonzalo and Britt, they were like, wow, this is a very long shot. We are not gonna get it. But we did. So there was a positive resolution by the Human Rights Council to establish an internationally binding instrument to regulate the activities of transnational corporations and other business enterprises under human rights law. So as you can hear, it became very technical very quickly, but it was a huge historical victory, because that resolution, who were against this resolution? United States, Canada, Japan, all the European Union countries, and a few, let's say, traditional allies of the West. And who were in favor? All African countries, many Asian countries, and many Latin American countries, and then some will abstain. So it was clearly, since the beginning, an initiative at the human rights system at the UN, where the big, rich, industrialized countries were really against, and you had those who are suffering the extraction and exploitation really in favor. So it really galvanized a global movement around this, which was also a result of the work of TNI, because TNI was one of the founding members of this global campaign.
The diplomacy that needed to be done to consolidate and maintain the unity of the southern governments, you have to pursue, you have to keep on fighting for the treaty to be focused on transnational corporations, because this, there is always that threat that it will become a treaty that may not have teeth if all corporations, including the local, the mom and pop shop in the corner will be part of the scope as well. So I think this is also an area of work where, again, the strong relationships and bonds between the different Global South and Global North organization was forged, and there is already that repertoire of actions and processes wherein you have a period where every one of us campaigners have to look at the new text, really scrutinize it, because we need to discuss what would be our strategy, how do we respond to this. So that's also, I think, also from the climate, from the trade campaign, that inside and outside work, where you work from the inside, you work with governments, you also do you do your people's diplomacy, the governments, to maintain their unity and to make their position stronger as well.
This treaty at the UN is still a process, so we don't have a treaty yet. A big success of this process, which TNI has a very important role, was that this process for an internationally binding instrument is known as the binding treaty. So at the international level, at that point, you only had the OECD guidelines for corporations, you have the UN guiding principles, and they were all basically voluntary approaches for corporations, similar to corporate social responsibility. So you will have those, in our opinion, false solutions for the real problems of corporate power. We're bringing the idea that no, we need regulation of corporations. We need a binding treaty to hold them accountable. And that really changed completely the debate. It was not easy. The first years, the approach, especially from the United States or the European Union, was either completely dismissive and not even showing up on the negotiations, or saying, we don't actually need this. And not only that, this will undermine other important efforts like these guiding principles. We were really insisting about the need of this. And I think the historical moment really showed that actually we did need these binding regulations, because the Wall Street crash really showed that this self-regulation mantra was just a lie. It's not only not working, but also when it doesn't work, we have to pay the cost. So this binding treaty process really had an enormous influence on the global debate on how to address transnational corporations' power. And that already has had a huge impact in different debates. So in the European Union, you cannot understand the recent due diligence law on the European Union on supply chains of transnational corporations without looking at the success of the binding treaty process at the UN. That also influenced national level laws, so the French law of duty of care or similar due diligence laws or supply chains in Germany and other countries, no, who also fed the European Union current law approved by the European Parliament. So if you look at the debate on transnational corporations in Europe, it's completely different than 10 years ago. So it's not anymore the question if we need to regulate transnational corporations, it's more about how are we going to regulate them.
Meanwhile, on both sides of the Atlantic, negotiations were underway about a new treaty, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. Its supporters claimed it would bring prosperity and growth. As resistance to it gathered pace, more and more people came to learn that it was in fact another powerful attempt to shield transnational businesses from accountability and to lower hard-won social, environmental, and worker protections. Here's Susan George speaking to ECOWAS Global in 2015.
You know, it's bad for consumers, it's bad for nature, for the planet, it's bad for health, it's bad for the food we eat. Every aspect of everyday life is affected. So, intellectual property, what you can do on the internet, if it costs you something. The TTIP is a way of changing all of the standards in Europe so that they will go down for Europeans. And the idea is, and they say this, the companies say this in the Transatlantic Economic Council, that they want to integrate our economies.
Yeah.
Well, that means integrate it downwards, because if we integrate, that means it doesn't mean that the U.S. standards are going to go up, which is what some U.S. trade unions thought for a while, that we could negotiate upwards, but they can't. It means that the standards are going to go down and that the judicial function is going to be privatized. And actually, we would lose both jobs and growth. Companies would leave, many things would be disrupted, small and medium enterprise would be affected. They're beginning to understand that they would not be able to keep the same clients. If you are a small or medium enterprise and you have one client to whom you are giving components, you're selling components to a car manufacturer or some business like that, and if that company leaves for the United States to set up there, then the small and medium enterprises in Europe are dead. There are a lot of things wrong with this treaty, which would affect a lot of small businesses, and the businesses could not use the judicial mechanism against the state because they're too small. They don't have enough money to support the costs of an arbitration trial like that. So they have nothing to gain from the treaty either. I'm all for small business, and they supply 85% of all the jobs in Europe. So, you know, that's where the real activity is. It's not with the great big transnational corporations.
Lucia Barsena has worked at TNI since 2019 and is a specialist in trade and investment policies.
I remember that we started to get some information from the different networks that we were engaged in Europe about treaty that was currently being negotiated between the European Union and the United States, which was a TTIP. And we started to discover the magnitude and the extent to what this treaty meant. So in that moment, where I was engaged currently as an activist, which was in Spain in Ecologistas en Acción, we decided to call a first assembly of different organizations, which were actually organizations that had already been engaged in the anti-globalization movement. It was hugely successful. We had around 50, 60 organizations present. And from that moment, we understood that this was something that was going to be very powerful to work with the movements, to strategize, to see what we needed to do in order to raise awareness, because at that moment, nobody was talking about the treaty. No media was talking about the treaty. So our first job was very clear, which had to do with bringing light, shedding light to what those negotiations were and to what the content of the agreement was and what impact it could have to the people and to the planet. So after those first meetings, we had to do some initial research to discover, to really untangle what the whole treaty was about. Also to remind that all of this was done through an activist base. I was working with Ecologistas en Acción, trying to coordinate the campaign. But at that moment, I was the only person who was actually working on this. The rest, we were all activists. And the campaign started to grow. We ended up having around 300 organizations. And from having traditional allies that you would suspect that would join such a campaign, we started to get interest from other organizations in Spain that at that moment were also active for other motives. Then we also had the peasants movements engaged because of the whole agro side of the treaty. We also had consumers organizations, and we had a lot of workers organizations at that moment that would engage. So for example, we even had the dock workers in Barcelona, they would join. We had there was a group of women called Kellys, which were women working in hotel services that would also join like the campaign. And of course, we also started to work a lot with trade unions. And we even had a group of small and medium enterprises that were also engaging in the campaign because they saw how this type of treaties would actually only benefit big transnational corporations in the expense of their own businesses. So we also had those groups. And of course, we also had a group of lawyers, judges, people that were working around justice because of the investment dispute settlement mechanisms and how they saw that this type of mechanisms were actually diminishing our justice systems. So just to say that it was around 300 organizations, very diverse from different angles. This was also like a very exciting movement to see how for the first time we could really like cross-pollinate the impact of a free trade agreement into so many different areas of life that everybody was engaging in this campaign.
Martin Jelsma has worked on TNI's Drugs and Democracy program for 3 decades.
So when, and that only started to happen like 15 years ago, 2012, Uruguay was the first country that legalized the cannabis economy. Yeah, the background to that also was that in terms of activities, one of the main important elements was that the drugs program organized informal drug policy dialogues in Latin America, in Europe, and in Southeast Asia. And those were meant to be spaces where, under Chatham House rule, so confidential, with people from governments, civil society, academia, and NUM agencies could sit together to discuss an agenda that TNI basically set up. And when we prepared the background documentation, we always co-hosted it with one government, because that otherwise it was too difficult for other governments to participate. But yeah, we've had like 40 of those types of meetings, and that had a real influence, because the UN spaces, there's not that kind of discussion going on. No? It's a long row of country statements, basically, and then, yeah, the very tedious process of finding some compromise on resolutions. But the forward-looking thinking was not at all happening in the UN space. So those European, Latin America, and Southeast Asia dialogues became an important forum for the more critical debate. And we organized a few of them with the Uruguayan government before it all happened. And cannabis became an issue, at least in the Latin America discussions, but also a bit in the European dialogues. And it's indeed we started to collaborate with there was then the Mujica government in Uruguay, so the former Tupamaro, Frente Amplio. So they were willing to make bold steps. They knew they couldn't really do it because it wasn't allowed under the treaties that they had signed. But yeah, also when they were forming the first government, that it was one of the issues they said, yeah, made total sense to just have to get rid of that part of the criminal economy and to just have state control, quality control, and to have a legal economy. And yeah, we had many discussions at that and it was for us one of the nicest things to work on, no? Because there was a government finally also that was willing to just do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Mujica himself said, when he was asked, aren't you afraid of US repercussions and what's going to happen if you do that? And he said, I've spent 60 years in prison, I've been tortured, I had 10 bullets in my body. Do you really think that I'm afraid to have a phone call from the US embassy to complain about what we're doing? So this courage, that was really so wonderful to work with. And it set in motion also, triggered, of course, a lot of international discussions as the first example. There were At the same time, in some U.S. states, similar moves in Washington and Colorado, things started to move within the U.S. And there was a first country that also, challenged by this bold move, challenged the including the UN system. So that also then helped Canada to make a similar move shortly later. So we became then, from then on, it became another additional element in the program to support legal regulation of the cannabis market, but we, in connection with our other priority, which was the defense of the farmers who were dependent on the illicit cultivation. Yeah, because simply legalizing cannabis doesn't immediately help them, because that was the big fear. And you could see that, especially from Canadian side, that at the moment things started to open up and the medical cannabis, especially, boomed around the world. There were like 50 countries that made the first small steps, but then more in the medical cannabis field. But Canadian companies immediately jumped on it. And there was a corporate capture that was very visible. That also that didn't really work out for them, for the companies, because the move from medical cannabis to recreational or adult use didn't come as soon as they had expected. Because if still until today, it's limited to relatively few countries that have taken bold steps as Uruguay and Canada have done. One of the priorities for us became a fair trade cannabis model to make sure that all those farmers that had supplied the international illegal cannabis market until then, and for whom it was an essential part of their livelihoods for decades, that they would not be fully closed out of this newly emerging legal markets. So we started to work also more in the Caribbean and in Morocco, and also in Colombia, then more with the cannabis farmers. And we organized exchanges between those regions and helped to make their case that they have to be included in the opening of these legal market spaces. And that, because I remember that one of the traditional growers in, I think it was St. Vincent in the Caribbean, said at some point, we have managed to survive decades of repression. They've come to destroy our fields, and we are still here. And we now fear that legalization will be able to accomplish what the war on drugs never did, basically pushing us out and ending our one of the last feasible livelihoods that we still have available. And so that is still now today a very important part of the work.
As 2019 passed and the world turned the page on a new decade, austerity, corporate crimes, militarism, authoritarianism, and the climate crisis would intensify. An abundance of new challenges and grave injustices were on the horizon. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and imperial projections across Eastern Europe and parts of Africa, Israel's genocidal onslaught in Palestine and unchecked aggression across the region, and COVID-19 were about to push the status quo to its limits.
There was this line from Gramsci where he says, a new world is seeking to be born out of the old, and this is a time of monsters. And he was speaking about the 1930s, late 20s and 30s. And I think we also, it speaks to our age, because that's where we are right now. The whole global liberal order falling apart. And what is replacing it is something probably, it was bad, but it might be replaced by something worse.
You've been listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a 5-part mini-series by the Transnational Institute on its 50th anniversary. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can discover more about the Transnational Institute at tni.org. Please consider supporting our vital and ongoing work at tni.org/donate. Interviews for this podcast were conducted by Sean Macheza, Dalia Goshinina, and Dennis Burke, with archival interviews by Fiona Dove, Ecowal Global, and Radio Mundo Real. The series is edited and produced by the Transnational Institute. Thanks to Eden Ruskin, Susan Bach-Morse, Anthony Bonnet, Fiona Dove, Eric Hymans, and the International Institute for Social History. This episode is dedicated to the memories of Praful Bidwai and Tessa Kirsten. Thank you for listening.